Hello, everybody, and welcome to What to Discuss Now. I am your host, AJ, and joined with me tonight is my co-host, Steve. And tonight, hey. We are going to take a look back at MacGruber and The Way of the Gun. It's a Ryan Phillippe double feature tonight.
And he's so dreamy.
And Steve, this was your first time actually watching MacGruber, wasn't it?
It was. I was always a big fan of the sketch on SNL. I remember it being a standout. And what, you know, with the series coming back on Peacock, I think it was Nolan or a big filmmaker that I like.
I think it was Christopher Nolan. Yeah.
He recently said something about the movie, you know, being good, or that he was a fan. And so that made me want to check it out. And you really liked it. And like I said, and I also remember, man, I have a lot of fond memories of being a little kid. And I think this helps of MacGyver. And
right. Yeah.
Yeah. And I remember being a little kid, and MacGyver was one of those shows that got, you know, I'm 36, so we're talking early 90s here, staying home. My brother kind of babysitting us. We watched a lot of TV and movies, you know. And I remember, I guess TBS or some channel had MacGyver in syndication, so it would play like every week morning, you know. Right. And it was just like he could always, like, he'd have like a concert ticket, a paper clip, and like an old like lint brush, and he would stop a nuclear deterrent, you know, like a nuclear bomb.
Did you ever see that skit where MacGyver actually showed up as MacGruber's dad?
No, that's perfect. I love that. But no,
need to watch that. It's like a 5-minute clip of MacGyver showing up.
That's perfect.
MacGruber's dad.
Oh man, I will have to go look that one up, because it was always a funny sketch, but like I tried to explain it to Gentry recently, and she didn't remember. Gentry's my girlfriend. And I didn't have time to I tried to explain it because she doesn't really remember MacGyver, and so she just didn't seem to get the humor in the initial sketches, which was my big thing was, will people find this funny if they didn't watch MacGyver? But
yeah, that is the thing. But I'm gonna tell you, I never watched MacGyver, but I got the point of MacGyver, right. And the sketches of MacGruber were always hilarious, and it always featured like their guest host on the skits. Like the Jonah Hill ones are priceless, I think.
Oh, I do remember that. I do remember that. Hysterical. Yeah, no, and that's how they would always incorporate that. You're right, is with the guest host. They would give the guest host a sketch to do. But with the movie, the movie came out in 2010, right? And the movie flopped.
It bombed hard.
Yes, it bombed hard. And I think I remember it also getting like abysmal reviews.
But you know what? The thing is, a lot of critics at the time thought it was good. They just didn't want to give it a good review because it was based off an SNL sketch, you know?
Well, that's the thing too, is with comedies, is that you'll see a critic walk into a I don't know if it's that bad now, but there was always been, especially even the Academy has always turned its nose up at comedy. So there would be instances where you have somebody laugh for 90 minutes and then they write a review about how dumb it was and, you know, give it like 2 out of 5 stars. And I think that's probably what you got a lot of with MacGruber. The movie is hysterical, and it definitely, like, there's something about it. The only, like, other time I can really think of another movie, and it's one from childhood again, that really I think would make a great double feature, is the awesome Charlie Sheen vehicle, Hot Shots, the Top Gun spoof.
Yeah, right.
And then you had
mentioned it, I do think it would make for a good double filling back to back.
Yeah, for sure. And you could even do, because then you had Top Gun Part Two. I love how it's the French, which was like more like a Rambo type.
I remember that. Yeah.
Yeah, and they had Lloyd Bridges as the president, who was, he had so many hysterical one-liners in those movies. And we could, that was one of those movies that we could quote, that we would just throw lines at each other laughing. You know what I mean? Trying to make each other laugh as kids. Like,
and you know what? MacGruber got it off like really quick in the movie, being so tongue in cheek with the MacGruber theme song, saying now he has his own movie.
I watched this the other night for the first time. And I got to tell you, it had been a while since I had just watched a comedy of that nature at all. And there were parts of it where, like, when he goes and builds he builds his whole team and then he accidentally kills them.
Yeah.
Like, there's so much, and just like the tonal shifts that are hilarious. Like, one minute, like, his boss is praising him, telling him, you know, what a great job he did, or how bad
he did. Powers Booth in this film.
Oh my God, so funny. And then, but one minute they're like telling him he's like basically like a god of military.
Yeah, they're
action.
Telling him one minute he's like an action Jackson kind of.
Yeah, and then he's a total like fuck up, and they like take the case from him like the next scene. Like, I was like, that's hysterical. But, you know, it's just like kind of poking fun at all these tropes and these, we don't even really see them anymore, like military porn. You know, they're like all these right. like movies like Navy SEALs and like all these movies, you know, even Top Gun is as good as a movie Top Gun is. It definitely is the type of movie I'm referring to when I say military porn, which was just like, you know, exactly right. what it
and
sounds
it was
like.
Much more of a military porn romance movie too.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And a lot of those had that element, like, you know, cause you had your boys, you had your dudes in the unit or whatever. And like, there was all those movies, and it was also a different time to where we had a right. different relationship with our military, which makes it all funnier now. Okay, when MacGruber, we've also got Kristen Wiig, who is hysterical. She's at the top of her game. This was like a year before Bridesmaids, I think.
Yeah.
So, like, it just kills, and she kills. I still am, like, you know, I'm a big DC guy, and I'd like to see Wonder Woman 1984 again sometime, but I got to tell you, I really didn't like it. And I was bummed out because I like Kristen Wiig. I love my DC. And so, yeah. You know, I was happy for her.
But maybe I'm a sucker for comic book films, but I enjoyed Wonder Woman 1984. Or maybe that can just be a fact that it was a screener I got from Warner Brothers 2, which was cool.
Well, yeah, that is cool. That is very cool. But I think that you just liked it. I mean, there were people that really, really did like it. And here's the thing. That one thing I do appreciate about the two different Wonder Woman films, and I get what Patty was trying to do, and some would say that she really, really pulled it off, and some would say she didn't, but is there is this whole element. Yes, we have our badass, like, Zack Snyder-influenced Wonder Woman, where she's a warrior, and she will, you know, kill you, and she's awesome, and but there's
it's
this whole other...
It's almost like two different down-to-nose playing Wonder Woman.
Yeah,
right?
Exactly. There's this whole other side to Wonder Woman where people that have fond memories of Linda Carter and like the spinning around and the invisible jet. And it's all very like it's all very happy and wholesome. And a lot of people really want to see that. And that's why you get that's why this whole movie exists. And like, you get that whole opening thing in the mall where just the tone of that, the opening showdown with those two criminals, where that came straight out of like Superman 3 almost from the 80s, seemed like it just let you know right up front, hey, this is a different side of Wonder Woman, which is totally
it's
gonna
be campy, it's gonna be, you know, blah blah blah.
More to me, like, now it's more to me that like that's not so automatically some people are gonna love that, some people are gonna go in interested, but me, that is not my thing, so I'm immediately gonna eyes glaze over. You know, because the tone of it is just too sunny for me. But right. I, you know, so Kristen Wiig was good in that though. But she's hysterical and stuff. Like, you know, you let her turn. I mean, I don't want to say she's better or worse than anything, but I just think MacGruber, she's really funny, and let's just leave it at that.
Yeah, and she's one of the top points in it. But one of my favorite
here it comes
and MacGruber is Ryan and
boom.
And one of the main reasons why is he looks so uncomfortably casted.
And he's so straight.
It just works.
He plays it so straight. He's like the ultimate straight man. Excuse me. He's the ultimate straight man in MacGruber. And I got hiccups, of course. And he just, it really, really works.
Yeah, and like, he looked so uncomfortable next to Real Forte the whole time. Just those two chemistry on this is what makes the movie even that much better upon viewings. Because you can just see little details about them going back and forth with each other, too.
And it's great because you get Will Forte's chemistry with Ryan, with Kristen Wiig, with Val Kilmer as well. You've got it just works. Like he's very funny to play off of, and I just can't imagine how hard it was not to bust out laughing. But with Ryan Phillippe, there's so many Felipe. I can't remember how you pronounce his last name. Sorry, Ryan.
We're close. He's not listening.
Call him Ryan. We just call him Rye Guy. Oh God, edit that out. But Ryan, there's all these funny moments. Like one of them that killed me was when he picks Ryan up and uses him as a shield, and he gets shot. Like, and he's like, "Wait a minute, did you just use me as a fucking shield? Let me out!" He like gets out. He gets shot like 3,700 times. Oh man. That part killed me. But there's so much stuff like that in MacGruber. So if you haven't seen MacGruber, basically, like, you know, it's just that every one of those movies, it's that Rambo 3 opening where they have to go to like the some Eastern, like Tibetan.
Yeah, it's one
monastery.
Of those tropes that it's like, you know, it's a suicide mission trope.
Yeah. It's like, we've got you. We've got to pull you. It's like, you know, bringing the guy out of retirement to do this one last score or whatever. I think the first one, now that trope of like, you got to bring the con man out to do one last con or whatever before he goes.
Yeah.
The one I can think of that did that really well was Thief, the Michael Mann movie with James Caan.
Yeah.
Which, I don't know if you've seen that, but it's
early. It's been a long time, but yeah.
Yeah, it's pre-Miami Vice Michael Mann, which I love Michael Mann. But that's interesting.
You know,
that,
Michael Mann is just one of my unsung favorite directors of all time, too.
Same, man. I love so many. Like, Collateral is one of my favorite movies.
Everybody goes to Heat, but he has so much more.
Heat. I love Heat. And I remember seeing Heat. I remember my brother. I had an older, cool brother that was into film, which is why I got to see a lot of stuff as it was happening. He was 15 when I was 10. So, like, Heat, Pulp Fiction, like, all that. That's what I think of that old time
period. And that was different when you could be, like, 15 and up to go see an R-rated film instead of...
Or we would just rent
movies. 18.
Yeah, or we would like the rental business back then. Like, I'll for sure, like, we had a 2-screen movie theater, and like, I think I've talked about this many times, but like, I have so many good memories of being like 12, for instance, and going to see Scream 2, and just it being packed, and like the employees would dress up as Ghostface and like walk up and down the aisles and stare at people, you know, and it was just a blast, but it was, you know, small town America, and like, I don't know, like, now we have a bigger theater here, an 8 cinema, you know what I mean? So, I mean, it's not the same, but I mean, at the same time, we have 8 screens here now in a nice theater. So, you know, you kind of, you give and take. We actually get movies that come here, some, you know, but, you know, to keep it on MacGruber though, the action is really goofy and over the top, but when you think about the movies that it's parodying, it's really like, yeah, well, those movies were goofy and over the top with their No One Reloads for 2 hours kind of thing. And, you know, but how about the part where he's like having sex
with his
dead wife in the cemetery?
Maya Rudolph in this film.
I love her.
God, she is.
Who is she married to? Somebody cool. I have to look that up
right now.
It's somebody really cool. But yeah, she is also, everybody in this kills. Like, so you get cool little fun parts like that. And I feel like we should talk about just mention Val Kilmer. Oh, yeah, that's what I thought.
This was Val Kilmer's best of the 2010s, I thought.
Easily. Maya Rudolph, real quick, is married to Paul Thomas Anderson, and that's what I thought.
I was thinking that, but I couldn't place the name.
I didn't want to say it and then it'd be wrong, so I Googled it real quick.
Yeah, which I am seeing Licorice Pizza on Tuesday
afternoon. You have to let me know. I can't wait.
Thomas Anderson is one of my favorite directors, too.
It's like you picked the sentence from my brain, word for word. I was about to say the same thing. I'm a huge fan.
Because I believe in the directing school of Paul Thomas Anderson and the acting school of Michael Shannon.
Oh, I like that. That's good. Good schools. Those are very fine schools. I would say that I believe in the acting school of Harry Dean Stanton and the directing school of David Lynch. That would be my two if I had to say that. But no, those are very fine.
David Lynch is always hit or miss with me, to be honest.
Well, I think he's hit or miss with a lot of people. He's a very singular, distinct artist. And so it just, not everybody likes his art. It's just how it is. That is what it is. David Lynch speaks to me in a very personal way. And people that are really into David Lynch, you'll find that it's Zack Snyder fans too. You'll get I always really like those directors. For some reason, they will speak to me.
You know what? We speak about this when Justice League came out and Army of the Dead. But if you're a Zack Snyder fan in the horror community, you're almost treated like a juggalo.
Yeah. And you know what? Fine. We'll all band together. My opinion matters as much as anybody else's, and
only people are saying that, and I found this, even some Facebook filmmakers say this, their critique of indie films have become much nicer and their critique of big budget films have grown meaner, and I'm just like, because you won't ever fucking get to do them.
That's true. Well, they probably, a lot of these guys, let's be honest, won't ever get to make an indie film either. I mean, let's be honest. You know what I mean?
Their indie budget is probably like $3,000 or something.
Well, you know, another thing too is I've just noticed that there's a lot of scam artists out there. I've seen people openly talk about how they will create Indiegogos for quote unquote movies that they're making when tax season, when people start to get their taxes every year. Because they know they can milk people for more money. And, I'm sorry, but, a lot of these projects that I see that people get excited for, it's like they're excited about everything except the actual movie. It's like, and I mean, I'm excited about this regional stripper adult star that we just got, that we just hired to come film for one day, and we're all really excited about the cool poster that we're giving out to everybody who forks over $250, some ridiculous amount, and then
I remember when the Terrifier 2 Indiegogo was going on and they reached their goal within 3 days or something, and they were still selling Blu-ray pre-orders for it for $75.
Damn, that's expensive. Then I just can't imagine, and those, you would like to think that those guys are a little more legitimate, but maybe not, because that's if people want to pay it, whatever, but I think that is a ridiculous amount. Now, I don't know what the hell the Blu-ray was, but I'm sure I'll be able to find Terrifier 2 for cheaper than $75. Knock yourself out, guys. If you want to pay for whatever you want to pay for, I pay some ridiculous amounts of stuff for collectibles. But I'm just talking specifically about people that are scam artists that aren't really making films, at all. That are, you know what I mean? The people that aren't even really making a movie that are just trying to scam people. So, you know what I'm saying?
Well, back to MacGruber.
Yeah. Well, that's the thing. Podcasts, that's the fun thing about podcasts. You start off on some surface level film talk, and within the hour, you could go anywhere from, philosophy to just have good conversations. Movies are just a springboard.
Right.
Yeah, for sure. But anyway, and MacGruber, basically, it is one of the funnier. If you look back at SNL films, a film that is a Lorne Michaels production. A lot of them are really bad.
Yeah, really bad.
But let's not forget, you know, we've got Wayne's World in there. Both
we
of those
got a movies. Night at the Roxbury in there, too.
That is, a lot of people love that movie. It's considered a classic by a lot of people. There is, it was on the tip of my tongue, and then I forgot. Oh, there is Tommy Boy and Black Sheep. You had both of the David Spade, Chris Farley matchups. Tommy
Which
Boy
I could never get into, even though I do like David Spade. Really? I could those just never get into the Chris Farley. I just could never
Really, that's crazy to me, but each their own. I think Chris Farley's an absolute genius. I love Chris Farley. I was very sad when Chris Farley died. But I remember I have very fond memories of going to see those at the movie theater as well. I definitely saw Tommy Boy was a rental. And then Black Sheep, I definitely saw in a packed house when I was like in middle school at some point whenever it came out. But anyway, you've got arguably, I know you said you didn't really like those movies, but those movies are definitely cultural touchstones and right, important. Yeah. You know, so that's like six or seven. And that was all, and you said that Coneheads movie. That's like eight movies. And now all those movies are from a time period or from like the early, and I forgot the early, we can't forget the early Adam Sandler mega hits like Billy Madison and Happy Gilmore. Those first couple
were. Can we forget about them?
Oh, dude, no, those movies are great. But, you know, those movies were phenoms. I definitely saw.
Did you ever watch the TV show Undeclared?
I remember Undeclared. I saw it when it was on TV, but that was like, my God, I was
because
young.
I remember the Adam Sandler cameo in there, and I'm the guy that totally talks to him like, dude, Billy Madison, and what was the other one, Happy Gilmore?
Yeah.
From punk rock, but everything else after that, dude, I just kind of
I don't know, man. I really like Adam Sandler.
Too, but I like him when he's not with his PG-13 clique.
Well, I don't know, man. I don't like a lot of those movies. And I honestly, to be fair, I haven't seen a lot of those movies. But, like, there's a market for those movies. And a lot of people think he's funny. And, like, I just don't like the snobbery people point towards him. Like, he's another one of those people that I don't like anything that people turn their – I don't like people that turn their nose up in whatever it's about. Like, I just say – like everybody wants to have some sort of superiority, you know what I'm saying? And I'm not saying you're doing that. I'm just saying that like Adam Sandler is one of those guys that people like to turn their nose up at and go, I know comedy more than you, because if you knew comedy, you wouldn't laugh at Adam Sandler. And like, I'm just like, what a fucking ridiculous attitude to have. The dude has made
and
billions.
That's what people were doing to us when we enjoyed Zack Snyder's.
Oh, for sure. Head. Yeah, when I enjoy a lot of things, yeah, a lot of stuff. That being a DC fan in 2016, 2017, remember that? What that was like, being a DC fan in 2017? My God.
I mean, even like, still, Marvel people are like that, too.
I know, DC, but it's not as loud as it was because there's too many answers back now. Like, and like, you know, there's James Gunn, there's Zack Snyder's movie turning out to, everyone admitted in the end that his cut, even if they didn't like it, that his cut was a far superior film. Right. I mean, it's an actual movie. I mean, the Justice League is not even a fucking movie. It really isn't. Like, it doesn't work as a full movie. Like, you know, like,
yeah, the Joss Whedon cut just feels like a commercial now compared to the
Snyder cut. It feels like they were trying to make an episode of like Super Friends, Justice. Yeah. And like, but the thing was, it's like, why were you trying to do that when the people that were excited about the movie definitely didn't want you to do that? Like, that was the last thing I wanted to see you attempt. I saw Justice League twice on opening weekend. It's the only time my head hurt. I remember it was such a painful experience the first time that I couldn't believe it. You know what I mean? And I had to go see it again to see if I could, you know, figure out.
Yeah, me and my dad went to go see the theatrical cut in theaters. Like,
me too.
After a month, it's been released, and it was still in packed house.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Yeah. that wasn't the case. And the drop-off on it was pretty big. Now, the drop-off in Suicide Squad was crazy. If Suicide Squad, if the drop-off wouldn't have happened, that movie might have made $1 billion. It still made like 730. I'm talking about David Ayer's. The first week, yeah, after word of mouth got out as to just all the problems in it, there was a, it's one of the biggest in Hollywood history. There was a 68% drop off between first week.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, it was so big. So it was just like, and it's just like morale, like being a DC fan was just like, it just sucked. Like it was just like everyone could not wait to just take every shot at you all the time. And, you know, and then there was the long, arduous journey to the Snyder Cut where people just pretended like you didn't know how movies were made. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, but that was the part that I got the most frustrated was when people were telling me who, one thing I know, it's movies. And I'm not an expert, but I have devoted my life to being just a fan. You know, I've taken some courses in school on in film, studied, you know, but I'm not trying to say I'm an expert. I'm just saying that I know enough about movies to where it's insulting when, you know, that whole the Snyder Cut doesn't exist nonsense. You know, when there was evidence that, you know, if you'd been reading along and following the news, you know, everybody acted like you had, it was such some deep secret. And I was like, if you guys would actually read, that's the problem. The internet is you guys don't read anymore. Nobody reads anything but a headline.
And everybody still says we got this covered too.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. God, what a bunch of fools. The worst side of all time. I'd like to nuke their office. But no, now the FBI is listening. But no,
we got this covered. It's following just some 10-year-old in his mom's basement.
Sad thing is, it's probably like 15 people with graduate degrees. That's the sad thing is it's probably a bunch. It's probably a few like smart people that, you know what I mean, or like, I mean educated people, not smart people. That's the sad thing.
And well, they're probably educated on how clickbait work too. So that's probably why they to generate more clicks.
For sure. I mean, that's all anybody wants anyway these days are clickbait articles. Because, you know, like I said, again, people don't read. But if they read, they would
find out that MacGruber is an excellent movie.
I was getting ready to say the same thing. I was getting ready to wrap it around and go, they would find out that MacGruber was actually hilarious. And maybe the good thing about the series,
you were going to go on about the Ayer cut.
No. That's what I thought was funny is I thought we were both about to say the same thing. But the funny thing about the series now, or the cool thing about the movie now, is that hopefully the series does well and people can discover the movie as well. You have seen the show already. I have not.
Yeah.
What's different about the show than the movie? How's it update? Does it have it's got to have somewhat of a different feel.
You know what? It's mainly much of the same. That's what makes it work.
Okay. So, and you said that it's like, okay, so it's like what? I think you told me like
eight episodes. Yeah.
So really, if there was a sequel script floating around Hollywood, let's say for a while, it may not have been much different than this.
Correct. Yeah.
Okay. Well, yeah. So basically this is like a 4-hour, what we're getting basically is just a longer MacGruber movie. Is it like that? Does it play?
Yeah,
like
it is. Yeah. Cause they bring everybody back and
it's not standalone episodes each week to where it's a different mission, or is it?
No, it's not. It's one continuous thing. So it does work like a sequel.
Oh, great. And you said they bring everybody back. Like who?
Ryan Felipe, Christian Rigg is back.
That's awesome. I didn't even know that yet.
However, Val is not back in the series.
Oh, well, you know, he's
had Val is sick, so yeah.
Yeah, he's had, but you know what? I do want to see his documentary. It's on my Prime. I haven't got a chance to watch it yet, but I'm definitely gonna. Have you seen it?
I have not.
I thought
it would be like too depressing to watch.
Oh yeah. Well, I mean, there's gonna be some sadness in there, but just in terms of like all the film footage of like work from, you know what I mean? There's a lot of cool, interesting stories for sure. But yeah, there'll be a tinge of sadness to it. But I think it's also,
I wonder if the Adam Marcus story will be in there about how Val kicked him in the nuts.
I don't know that story, or I've forgotten it.
Yeah, I think I told you about it in like one of our episodes.
It's like vaguely familiar, but remind me.
So something happened on the film Conspiracy. Adam was directing. He was telling me and
I don't even remember
co-host a story about it on the episode we had him on, and it was about him kicking him in the nuts. So I think if you go back and listen to the episode when we have Adam Marcus on, he talks about it.
Okay, I'll find it. You said those were the previous hosts, right?
Yeah.
Co-host. I was going to say, I don't remember. I was going to say, I'd remember that. But
yeah, this is in the early days. Yeah.
Ah, the old, old days, the pre-Steve days.
Better times.
But yeah, no, Val Kilmer is awesome in it. You know, it's crazy just how much it just reminds me. I hate to say this because I'm not trying to say anything. I'm not trying to make him out to be anything. I'm just saying that seeing Val Kilmer that healthy as recently as 2010, and then now he, you know, I mean, the guy's been sick. He had serious cancer. And yeah, he was, you know, he looked great for having kicked cancer's ass or whatever, but you know, he does not look like the dashing A-lister that he once was, for sure.
Well, even in the 2010 movie, he didn't look like the A-lister.
I think he looks good there, though, man. I just thought he looked good. I was just, and that's my whole point, is just like, it made me think about my own mortality, you know, because we never know what's going to happen, you know? Mm-hmm. And it just definitely hit me there a little bit, too, seeing him so healthy. But I do that a lot in movies, you know what I mean? Like, I really, you know, I love Philip Seymour Hoffman, and that one's, that's a personal thing to me too. So, you know, when I just see stuff like that, I just think about, you know, he was a guy that was on top of his game.
Yeah, he was one of my favorite actors.
How about Michael? Oh, for sure. Me too. That hit me hard as a, you know, a drug, as a recovering heroin addict. So I'll just, you know, I'll say it. I don't care. That's part of the problem, is nobody will just talk about mental health and addiction. But yeah, so when you see something like that happen as recently, and you have people that you cared about in your life, that a lot of people that died like that, and that are still, ones that aren't dead are still, you know, suffering and struggling, especially now in the middle of a 2-year going counting global pandemic, you know, it just there's a lot of what show were you just talking about?
MacGruber?
No, not MacGruber.
Oh, Dope Sick?
There's a show like Dope Sick that's out, and I have not been able to watch it yet because that is like,
it's really close to you too, because it's in Virginia, isn't it?
I don't know where it takes place, but it could take place here because, I mean, all of that happened here. And I mean, it's close to my heart in general inside, and my, because it's the life I've lived. I've been very much, life is intertwined with the opioid crisis epidemic. And that show Dope Sick, someday I will bring myself to watch it. But not right now. I just, you know what I mean?
Which is totally understandable.
Mate. It's a life that I have, you know what I mean? Like, I doubt that people, like a lot of Jewish folk that lived through the Holocaust, probably didn't want to see concentration camp docudramas for a while.
Or they probably didn't want to watch Hunters on Amazon Prime as well.
God damn, that show fucking bugged me out, dude. Did you like it?
I mean, I did at the time, but now I kind of like Jordan Peele.
Yeah, well, I like Jordan Peele a lot as a director. I just think that a lot of the stuff that he produces, like Hunters and Twilight Zone,
it's just too much in your face about it, dude.
Well, the Hunters thing that bothered me, but Jordan Peele is one. He's one of my favorite filmmakers working today. Like both of his like the movies that he's made, Get Out and Up. I think Up. Jordan Peele's Up. That'd be a different movie. But anyway, I really like his movies that he has actually like written and directed, but stuff he produces like Hunters, like, there's some stuff in that to me that's like questionable as why did we need that? Okay. The Holocaust was horrific enough to make up things like, Jewish people being forced on a life-size chessboard that someone made at Auschwitz, and you know, then you kill them as the game goes on. Like, I just don't think, I think it's too comic booky, like that kind of thing to add about Auschwitz, because it was horrific enough. We don't have to like make it to where like Dr. Evil's there stroking a cat, do we? Like, you know what I mean? Like, it just to me, like, you're cheapening.
And that's the problem I'm having of Jordan Peele's produced stuff now.
Yeah, a lot of it does that for me. Like, it just, a lot of it paints in very broad strokes, and I think that it's messy. Like, I think a lot of it has good intentions.
Like, what, it's more subtle when he writes and directs it. But
I love his two movies. Like, I really think they're great. And
but when he produces it,
yeah,
and even co-writes some stuff that he produces too, it's just more in your face, I think.
Yeah, and you know, I'm not impressed with Nia DaCosta. Like, I'm just not impressed.
I'm just not either. I hated the new
He's camera. Got an eye. She's got a filmmaker's eye, don't get me wrong. You know what I mean? Like, she can make like pretty shots, and she's got a good cinematographer's eye and all that kind of stuff. So as a like a DP, I can see, because the Candyman movie I thought visually had some interesting stuff going on.
Yeah, it looks pretty stunning, but overall, but I hated it.
I don't know. I don't know. I will watch it again someday, but not today. see if my opinion changes. But also, the original Candyman is, like, to me, perfect. And the problematic natures of it, in turn, some of the more problematic aspects of it or whatever, I think are some of the very same things that make it such a good movie. And you know what I mean? That makes
it scares you more than just using gore as a scare factor.
Oh yeah. It's just scary. I mean, you've got Philip Glass. I mean, it's a hard movie to beat, to be fair. Like, it's a hard movie. I wouldn't remake Candyman. You know what I mean? Like, it's got
like Philip after Glass's, seeing Bernard Rose directing Candyman.
Oh dude, his other movie is streaming on BFI. He had this movie in the late 80s.
It was like a kid's movie too, wasn't it?
I don't know. Yeah. It's
supposed to be the Paper House, wasn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. And it was impossible to see forever, pretty much.
I rented that from a video store here, actually.
Yeah. No, I mean, in the age of streaming, it was impossible to. Where, and it was recently streaming. Hopefully it still is, because I just reminded myself of that. It was around Halloween, so maybe it still is. But on BFI, the BFI channel on Amazon Prime, it was streaming on there, if anybody's interested. And yeah, Bernard Rose, he's a guy I never understood why he didn't work more, why he didn't get more work.
Yeah, because didn't he have another big film after Candyman that didn't do so well?
Oh,
like, dude, I don't know if it was a big film, but it had like a decent cast.
Yeah. I am not sure. Oh yeah, he Immortal Beloved.
Yeah.
In 94. That was about Beethoven, and Gary Oldman played him. And so I don't know if maybe that movie. Okay, well, it says that movie only made $9.9 million at the box office. So it doesn't have terrible reviews. It's got mixed reviews, but I don't know. So maybe that lost somebody some money. But then he also did an Anna Karenina, with Sophia Marceau and Sean Bean and Alfred Molina and Mia Kirshner. So he did a couple more films, but I'm guessing, I don't know what happened. I don't know.
So he never really like
stuck around. Oh, he lost. Okay, so that movie. Okay, so listen, he made two flops in a row after Warner Brothers. The 94 Immortal Beloved made $9.9 million off $28 million. Woo! And listen to this. The Anna Karenina movie I just mentioned, $30 million budget, $2.2 million at the box office.
Yeah, that could kill a career. So
yeah. So maybe that answers our own question. Next thing you know, he's a professor of film somewhere.
I mean, hell, he could be, but...
Well, hell yeah, I'm sure he... I actually think he did teach for a long time.
I mean, Matthew McConaughey is teaching acting classes, so who knows?
Oh, hey, just, you know, people need to well, never mind. I was going to take it. I was just going to take a shot at James Franco, and really, do we need to at this point?
I mean, after... I mean, I guess he got the same advice from Alec Baldwin to do an interview.
Why did they do that to themselves? Why?
I mean, that Alec Baldwin, he shouldn't have done that interview.
Woo!
That interview just killed his career.
Well, it's like, it's crazy of all the things that Alec Baldwin has survived. I remember when Alec Baldwin, on a voicemail, they got his voicemails, and he was calling his daughter a fat piggy, and that she disgusted him. Do you remember that? She was like 9 years old.
No, I don't remember that.
This was in like 2010. He was in this tirade yelling at his daughter because she skipped out.
Oh, and this was on the peak of 30 Rock. Or was this after 30 Rock?
2010. I think this was still at the peak of 30 Rock, if I'm being honest. 30 Rock was definitely on the air, I think, in 2010. Or he was still basking in the glow of it, but I think it was still on. But he was yelling at his daughter on a tirade about her missing some therapist appointment. But the thing is, and he called her a fat piggy and talked about how she disgusted him. But she was like 11 or 12 years old at the time. And it was just like a horrendous, like verbally abusive email to get from your father. It was like, whoa, you know, it was like, this is abuse. Like, this is totally abusive. And I'm not, somebody can be an asshole or abusive. And I'm not saying one time or something, or, you know, people can change. I don't hate Alec Baldwin or anything like that. I don't know the man. And I like a lot of the stuff he's done in movies, but like the interview was, it's just like, don't they have PR people that are getting paid a lot of money to stop that from happening? Like, I don't understand. And the way he even looked, like, was the idea going in that interview was that he was just so beside himself that he looked like shit? You know?
Like, yeah, because he looked awful in that interview. Awful. I didn't watch any of it, but I saw him like this, because you know how they do promo clips online and stuff. So I saw him like, one little clip, and he just looked terrible.
And what's he, like, crying? Was he, like, crying?
I think so, yeah.
Well, yeah, he did break down into tears, in part. So, it's I don't mean to make light of that situation, because it's obviously there's nothing to make light of. It's tragic, and it speaks to a need for safety, I think, and just... you know, more safety and less guns on film sets. That's what it says to me, more safety and less guns on film sets. And I'm not, I don't know the whole story enough to, what I will say is I don't think as an actor that he did anything wrong. I think that where all of the blame for him would come into it would be as one of the film's main producers on a set that was obviously out of control.
Right.
That's where I have. I don't have any kind of like, well, he shot the man, he's guilty. No. That's crazy, I think. But
yeah, but in today's modern universe, it's guilty until proven innocent right now.
Yeah. Right. In which I call me old fashioned, but I'm an American, so I refuse to play that game.
Yeah, I do too, but it's still how people. The majority of people think,
and this is a lot of people have always been that way, to be truthful. A lot of people have always been quick to want to go see a hanging, you know.
Yep. All right, but, so now on to The Way of the Gun.
Let's do this. Way of the Gun, I rewatched it just today.
I watched it for the first time this week and was just blown away.
Yeah, and you know, I had that movie on DVD when I was 15, right? It was like a blind buy. It was just a blind buy, and I bought it, took it home, and like you said, and imagine seeing it for the first time when you're 15, you know, and you're into like film, like, you know, you're just trying to always find the next cool thing. And I could never tell anybody about this movie. Nobody cared, and nobody ever really has seen it. And the thing is, I was even surprised today. I never looked up who did it. And it's Christopher McQuarrie, who did the last two Mission Impossible movies, Jack. And he's written a bunch of things. When he made this movie, it was the first movie he directed. He had just come off winning an Oscar for the writing The Usual Suspects.
And after The Usual Suspects to this. And he got Ryan Phillippe early in his career. And he got Benicio Del Toro early in his career.
And it's Benicio after he had already, like, you know, he was also in Usual Suspects. And this is Benicio after he did Usual Suspects and after he did Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
And you got Juliette Lewis, who is just terrific in this.
And she's terrific in everything. I'm watching Yellow Jackets right now. She's terrific in it.
Yeah, I still haven't watched that. I'm thinking of just waiting until the season ends and then just watching it at that.
Yeah, because it's a limited series, I'm pretty sure. So just binge it. I'm telling you, that and Dexter paired up on Sunday nights has been nice.
Yeah, I've been reading that in my news feed. And then
do people like the new? Anyway, go ahead.
No, I love the new Dexter. Me and my dad have been watching it every Sunday morning.
Yeah, I did too. I watched it this morning. I watched the new one this morning.
Because if people don't know this by now, if you have Showtime Anytime downloaded on any streaming device, they actually upload their Sunday TV series every Sunday morning, so you don't have to wait till Monday or Sunday night to watch it on TV.
Right. Well, AMC does the same thing. If you do AMC Plus, like, you have everything on Friday.
Right.
Like, you get your Walking Dead or what, you know, anything on 2 days early. So a lot of those services do that kind of thing. But anyway, Way of the Gun. So you got that. You've also got Taye Diggs. Taye Diggs is a hot rising star. He's coming off of big hits at the time, like How Stella Got Her Groove Back and Go, which Go was a very popular movie that people seem to have forgotten. It was kind of like Pulp Fiction in a rave setting. Did you ever see that?
I don't think I have.
You need to see Go sometime because it's a blast. It had that. Anyway, so you got Taye Diggs, and he was also in, people may not even remember this now, but he was in the original Broadway cast of Rent before that. So, yeah, Taye Diggs.
Oh, wow, yeah.
Yeah, he was doing a lot of cool
Diggs
stuff.
This was early in his career then, too, right?
Yeah, like I said, he was like the young hot stud in this movie, a very popular black film, and a film also popular with, like, kind of middle-aged soccer moms or whatever, what have you, in the late 90s called How Stella Got Her Groove Back, where he romanced Stella, played by Angela Bassett, who was older but foxy, you know, and so he got her groove back. Taye Diggs was definitely a sex symbol. So anyway, you got Taye Diggs, you got Benicio, you got Ryan. Okay, you got James Caan in one of the coolest performances of his entire career outside of Sonny Corleone. Yeah, I thought that James Caan in this movie, every time he opens his mouth, he's playing it so deep, and he just sounds like the back cover of a hard-boiled detective novel, you know, like every time he speaks.
Yeah.
He's awesome in it. And so you've got more people than that. You've got Scott Wilson, who, speaking of Walking Dead, was later Herschel on Walking Dead. You've got others too, whose names are kind of slipping me. You know, that one guy, Abner, that's like, I want to be alone now, I'm dying, in that one part. The other old guy, do you recognize him as Banjo and Sullivan from Devil's Rejects, the band that they kidnap or whatever. He's the main guy. I don't know if you saw that or not. The Devil's the Rob Zombie film. But he's in that. But anyway, the way the gun is very, at the time, it was kind of, it didn't do well, I think, just because of the time. It was ahead of its time. It was very hard boiled. It definitely got its influences from those kind of detective novels that I kind of mentioned in Pulp Fiction as a genre. And definitely, too, is a movie that exists in a post-Tarantino world.
And I got that vibe watching it, too. Like, you can tell it came around when the Tarantino finally, like, changed independent filmmaking for a long time.
Yeah.
Well, it kind of had that vibe, yeah.
When Reservoir Dogs came out in 92, and then True Romance came out in 93, and then even like the big nuclear bomb was Pulp Fiction in 94. And so then after that, you had all these crime movies that were all vying to be the next Pulp Fiction. And you had all kinds of movies. Like you had Fargo, that was Coen Brothers' masterpiece, that was lumped in there with that. You had, like, you know, Heat is another great 90s, like, you know, crime movie that was lumped in there with that. But, and you had stuff like Out of Sight from Soderbergh. There was all kinds of stuff. So this got lumped in there with that. And I think where this came out a little later in like 2000, this was after Tarantino does Jackie Brown in 97. And then he gets quiet. The most quiet he ever was in his career. For, you know, like 7 years between Jackie Brown and Kill Bill. And so by this point, I think people are a little Tarantino crimed out, and everything seems kind of
Tarantino fatigued at this moment.
Yeah. And I think that because he definitely went off, and he didn't reinvent himself. He just broadened his scope. And it was a reinvention, but it's not like he like threw away what he'd done before. He was just like, no, I can do this too. But so in 2000, it just, Way of the Gun was just out of place. And so it didn't do well. It's hard boiled. And the thing is that Christopher McQuarrie wanted nobody to be likable. He didn't want anybody to have any of the standards.
And that's a hard sell to a lot of people. Like, even my, when I was taking this class in introduction to film at my college, my teacher was talking to me about Paul Thomas Anderson films, and I was like, I love all of them, really. And he was like,
me
do
too.
You like The Master? And I was like, yeah. He was like, see, that was a no-go for me because I have to like some of the characters in the movie.
That kills me, man. This whole idea, I think that likability is a big problem with why blockbusters feel so flat today. Quest for likability is ridiculous because that's just like, it's so hard to, like, Joker was so subversive for this reason, I feel like, is that now people have been raised on, I think, movies that show, you know, your good guy's your good guy and your bad guy's your bad guy, and never the two shall meet, and everybody is so likable.
And you know,
everybody
what?
Has to be likable.
Since you said that, I went to It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, of course, when Frank is describing the old ways of filmmaking. You know, the good guys wore white or were right, and the bad guys wore black, or they ended up being black in the movie.
Oh, God. And that's a good show. It's a good example, is that there's a group of people who are entirely unlikable scumbags, you know? And with Seinfeld, that was the thing, too, was Seinfeld was a show about a group of pretty bad people. A lot of people compare the two shows and kind of say, I've heard people say that, like, It's Always Sunny is like Seinfeld on meth.
Yeah, which is funny because I never watched Seinfeld, but I just don't really like Jerry Seinfeld, but I love Larry David.
Yeah, well, you should watch Seinfeld then, because you've got both of their minds just as much as you've got just as much Larry in there as you got Jerry. If you can, you can get past your distaste of Jerry, I think you'd find a lot.
But it does have Jerry Stiller in there as well, doesn't it?
Yeah. Jerry what?
Stiller.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Jerry Stiller plays, oh gosh, I think he's George's dad.
Yeah, because if he's in it quite a bit, I can get past some of that stuff.
Yeah, he's in a lot. He was definitely a recurring character for sure. Like there's a lot of funny, memorable Seinfeld moments.
You may not agree with me, but I enjoyed The Kings of Queen when it was on, like its peak sitcom.
This show was huge.
You know, The King of Queens and Everybody Loves Raymond.
Yeah. Those are not my deal. I can't really get into either one of those shows. But those shows all stem from a show that I love, like the whole working class kind of thing. Like, we're a working class family or whatever. Roseanne is one of my favorite shows of all time. I grew up on Roseanne. That show was the first time as a kid you just saw that type of regular American family on TV, you know, that didn't, you know, because like stuff like Married with Children was funny and it did show like a raunchy family, but they didn't seem like a real family, you know, like.
Yeah, and you got a Third Rock from the Sun as well.
I remember Third Rock too a little bit later, but Roseanne had just was totally awesome and was just a total curveball into the system. And I think it's really fucked up what happened to Roseanne. I just have to be honest. I don't agree with them taking her entire legacy from her because she made a bad joke and repackaging it without her. I think it's pretty insulting.
Yeah, because we all make bad decisions and bad jokes sometimes, but you know, living is just part of, you know, making yourself a better person.
Yeah, and firing her may have been one thing, but firing her and taking Roseanne and repackaging it as the Connors, and having her character die of an OxyContin overdose was fucking insensitive, was insulting. Those are the people that are supposed to be the good guys. You know, it's like, okay, whatever, I don't think so.
Yeah, like I understood it perfectly when Two and a Half Men did that, because that was really called for.
That was his fault. That was I always thought that seemed like, I mean, he was the highest paid actor in television history at that point in time. When he did that, when he went, now I know he had all kinds of problems, and I'm a drug addict, but I'm just saying, as drug addicts, when you're using, you can make horrendous decisions, you know, and that's what he did, you know. He made it horrendous. He was obviously on a lot of like crystal meth is what all that sounded like to me. All that crazy talk of you know, the thing about Charlie Sheen was it's just another example of how gross the media is, because you have somebody that's like a drug addict that is so out of his mind with addiction that, like I said, he was getting paid millions of dollars per episode to be on a sitcom, and he self-destructed, and then, you know, the media decides that it's time now to follow him around everywhere and laugh at him. Well, you know what I mean? As he's going crazy and give him a microphone. I just think that's disgusting.
And I think he gave Brie Olsen AIDS or HIV, one of those two.
Who's Brie Olsen?
The porn star he was with.
Oh, really? Yeah, well, I know that I don't know if he's HIV positive or if he had AIDS. I don't know which one, to be honest, but that's awful. That's awful. I mean, it's just awful. The whole situation it's just tragic. I mean, really, it is. And I mean, to have now, okay, but then it comes out that whole Corey Haim story about Lucas. Do you remember that?
Yeah, and I remembered Corey Feldman's whole documentary about it.
Do you believe that Charlie Sheen raped him? That he raped Corey Haim? It's dark, man. It's dark. I don't know who said what. I don't know if his mom, because his mom says not to listen to Feldman, because, and I don't, you know, I don't really like Feldman. I think Feldman
seems to be still like only trying to be relevant off of Haim's.
That's how I feel like. And so, yes, thank you. No, people get mad when I say that. And that's how I feel. And also, Corey Feldman, you know, he seemed to have gotten hurt when he was a kid, and my heart goes out to him. But like now he has all these young girls in his quote unquote shitty band that like he dresses up as angels that all live in the house with him. So it seems to me like he's
that's
like
some Mark Kelly stuff, man.
Yeah, it seems to me like he's hurting people now in much the same way he was hurt, which does happen quite a bit. You know, abusers abuse, that kind of thing. So I think that, you know, I just think that he's a con artist and he was a good actor.
I get that feeling too.
I liked Corey Feldman's stuff as a kid. You know, I'm not going to yell at a 12-year-old kid from the 80s, but like, you know, like now I would not give a dollar to Corey Feldman to do anything, except maybe go away.
Like, you know what? I did rent that documentary when it came out. Because I was interested in it. I thought it was going to be like this huge pedophilia ring takedown in Hollywood. And then it was just that Lucas story for like 2 hours.
That's crazy. See, that's gross because there's actually nothing to back that up other than him saying that. And also, man, Corey Feldman also will sit there and call the Michael Jackson accusers liars, right? Now, I'm not getting into who is a liar and who's not, because it's not my job. I don't know. But I do know this, that if you're going to base your entire career off of like your career reinvention, quote unquote, off of
then I'm this, you should have Ryan Felipe's accent in the way of the gun.
Oh, really? I don't know, man. It's not the best.
Once I heard that accent, I was like, what the hell is going on here?
Well, it changes too, like the whole time.
Yeah, I noticed that throughout the film, it does change quite a bit.
Yeah. It's not the best part about it. But you know, Ryan Phillippe was always a guy, you know, he started out in that late generation of teen slash, those MTV teen
Pretty
slash
boy stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. He was in I Know What You Did Last Summer, and he was in Cruel Intentions. And, you know,
which is a really surprising fun flick, by the way. It's not just.
Hey, you know, I like I Know What You Did Last Summer as well. I saw that in the movie theater too. I thought that was a fun little whodunit.
Yeah. Cruel Intentions. Are you sure that wasn't Freddie Prinze Jr. in it, or was that Ryan?
They're both in it.
Oh, they're both in it. Okay.
Yep. Yeah, they're both in that one. He's dating Ryan Felipe is dating Sarah Michelle Gellar's character, and Freddie Prinze Jr. is dating Jennifer Love Hewitt. And I Know What You Did Last Summer. Yep. Only one survives. Oh, sorry. Ryan Felipe is always a guy that really wanted to be taken seriously. And he would go out of his way to not go out of his way. He just did take himself. He wanted to be taken seriously. He wanted to be, let me see. He wanted to be seen as a serious actor. And he also did the movie that we cut Breach.
Yeah, Breach. And he was fantastic in that, but we'll just do a quick highlight of just how fantastic he was with the Chris Cooper in that.
He was great. They did play off each other really well. That's a story about an FBI agent that was tasked with bringing in an older FBI agent who was selling state secrets to the Russians.
Yeah, and it was around the time the Patriot Act.
Yeah. So you had a lot of tensions going on with the Patriot Act that kind of mirror itself in here because it goes really deep into a lot about.
And I think I want to say something here, but I'm not totally sure. But I think the Patriot Act also gave cops like stuff to not need a warrant to kind of do actions that they feel are necessary.
True. The Patriot Act was the moment that we the Patriot Act is like, in my opinion, when Hitler suspended all the civil rights in Germany after the Reichstag fire. You know, it was like a power grab. The Patriot Act is the worst. That was one of the nails in America's coffin, a big one. I think it's terrible. You know, I mean, it's just we traded all of our privacy away. They took it.
Yep.
They took it.
They took it. It was Republicans and Democrats alike. Trust me. They took those guys.
They took it. Here. They took it.
Those goobacks. No. So Brittany. And Ron Philby did other things too, like the Paul Haggis film Traffic. In 04, he plays this racist cop, and he's good in that. So there was just all these, you know, he just would go out of his way to not star. I'm sure he turned.
Oh, he was in Traffic. Was that the Don Cheadle film too?
No, I'm sorry, not Traffic. Traffic is in Crash is the one I meant to say. And not the good Crash, not the Cronenberg Crash, the shitty Paul Haggis one that beat Brokeback Mountain for the Oscars.
That's a picture, yeah.
That's a bad, I don't think Crash is a very good movie, but I do think Ryan Phillippe is good in it, in that opening scene where he ends up shooting that Mexican kid and like hiding his body. I thought that was, you know, awesome. He was just really cool in it. But anyway, so there's all these instances of where I can just see Ryan Phillippe's agent getting frustrated because he would make him throw away like all these rom-coms and stuff that would come in. Right. I would just picture, you know, because he just didn't want to do that kind of thing. So, you know, you've seen him do some interesting stuff throughout the years instead, but he definitely traded in his leading man status for that forever. Because then he aged out of playing all those roles and they just, you know, went away.
And when he does the leading man stuff now, it's mainly straight to videos on demand or straight to DVD at the moment.
He's still working, though. He's still working.
He is still working a lot, yeah.
I don't think anybody should knock the man for working. And I like a lot of straight to DVD movies. I'm sure we both do.
Yeah, but my straight to DVD movies include something else, but.
Or anyway, it's called Way of the. It's called Way. It's called Way of the sexy time. Damn it! I got nothing. Yeah, but the Way of the Gun is a throwback to more hard-boiled noir driven stuff.
Yeah, I got that too. Yeah,
it's got elements of like spaghetti westerns, especially at the end.
Yeah, especially in the beginning, too, when it's Ryan Phillippe's monologue that he does.
Yeah, it closes out on that, too. And just that whole final showdown is you know, all you had to do is put cowboy hats on them and, you know, just change their clothes and you could have that.
Suit out in front of the hospital had that spaghetti restaurant vibe to it.
Oh, yeah. So that was kind of the whole deal of it, and it didn't do well, but it's an awesome movie. And like we said, Christopher McQuarrie, if you don't know that name, he won an Oscar in 96 for, was, I think, his very first screenplay, which was Usual Suspects. And Bryan Singer directed that, and he wrote it, and he won the Oscar. So that was right off the bat. So that's really the only reason he gets to make this movie and direct and write it is because of he cashed in his Oscar capital. And so he wrote a lot of things throughout the years, but he's most known now as being the guy that made the last Mission Impossible Fallout, and the last two, and he's making the seventh one.
Yeah, and the last two have probably been some of the best ones in the.
Oh, they've been the best ones. Yeah, and they just keep that franchise is awesome. And he made the Jack Reacher movie. He's done a lot of stuff throughout the years, and so you get to see a guy now who is a Hollywood titan, and you get to see him in his infancy as a director for sure. This was his first directed film. And it was his follow-up. It was his Oscar follow-up. And it is a total – the one thing Wikipedia I like is the one update. And there's like an asterisk after everything that says this is now considered a cult film. I was like, yeah, it is. I was like, yeah. But, no, so I you know, I would give The Way of the Gun just because we didn't do it earlier. Going back to the beginning with MacGruber – I would give MacGruber a 4 out of 5. MacGruber is hilarious, and it's a great spoof. It's a great SNL film.
The test of time, too.
What would you give MacGruber?
I would be right there with you with like a 3.5 or a 4 out of 5.
Word. And if you've seen the series, I'm just curious, do you know what you would give the series?
Yeah, I would give it possibly the same grade, if not a 5 out of 5 on the series.
Oh, yeah? Cool. Especially I'm going to have to watch the series when we hang out.
In the series, too.
What'd you say?
Because of Lawrence Fishburne in the series as well, and Sam Bentley.
I got to say, I missed Lawrence Fishburne in The Matrix Resurrections.